That episode, Living As If the Truth Were True, is one of all too many Unwelcome Guests Back episodes which are at least as relevant today as when they were made, and that was over a decade ago. We live now in a world in which every year corporate media admits that economic wealth and privilege is concentrated in ever fewer hands, and yet at the same time manages to keep off the table any real discussion about whether we would like to change this and how we might do this. To my eyes, that's a major glitch in the matrix, to say that, yes, we live in a democratic world in which the will of the people is properly represented by their elected leaders, the politicians, and yet at the same time to say more and more people are living in dire poverty and are deprived of their basic requirements to survive. For an expose of just how that contradiction came to be, we turn to one of our major pieces. This is Richard K. Moore's essay, Escaping the Matrix, which Lingeri read in episode 87.
Moore begins the article by asking, "Are you ready for the red pill?" The defining dramatic moment in the film The Matrix occurs just after Morpheus invites Neo to choose between a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill promises the truth, nothing more. Neo takes the red pill and awakes to reality, something utterly different from anything Neo or the audience could have expected. What Neo had assumed to be reality turned out to be only a collective illusion, fabricated by the Matrix and fed to a population that is asleep, cocooned in grotesque embryonic pods. In Plato's famous parable about the shadows on the walls of the cave, true reality is at least reflected in perceived reality. In the Matrix world, true reality and perceived reality exist on entirely different planes. The story is intended as a metaphor, and the parallels that drew my attention had to do with political reality. This article offers a particular perspective on what's going on in the world and how things got to be that way in this era of globalization. From that red pill perspective, everyday media consensus reality, like the Matrix in the film, is seen to be a fabricated collective illusion. Like Neo, I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began, but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense. I read scores of histories and biographies, observing connections between them, and began to develop my own theories about roots of various historical events. I found myself largely in agreement with writers like Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, but I also perceived important patterns that others seemed to have missed. When I started tracing historical forces and began to interpret present-day events from a historical perspective, I could see the same old dynamics at work and found a meaning in the unfolding events far different from what official pronouncements proclaimed. Such pronouncements are, after all, public relations fare given out by politicians who want to look good to the voters. Most of us expect rhetoric from politicians and take what they say with a grain of salt. But as my own picture of present reality came into focus, grain of salt no longer worked as a metaphor. I began to see that consensus reality, as generated by official rhetoric and amplified by mass media, bears very little relationship to actual reality. The Matrix was a metaphor I was ready for. In consensus reality, the blue pill perspective, left and right are two ends of the political spectrum. Politics is a tug of war between competing factions carried out by political parties and elected representatives. Society gets pulled this way and that within the political spectrum, reflecting the interests of whichever party won the last election. The left and right are therefore political enemies. Each side is convinced that it knows how to make society better. Each believes the other enjoys undue influence, and each blames the other for the political stalemate that apparently prevents society from dealing effectively with its problems. This perspective on the political process and on the roles of left and right is very far from reality. It is a fabricated collective illusion. Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is the world that was pulled over your eyes to hide you from the truth. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. Consensus political reality is precisely such a matrix. Later, we'll take a fresh look at the role of left and right and at national politics. But first, we must develop our red pill historical perspective. I've had to condense the arguments to bare essentials. Please see the annotated sources at the end for more thorough treatments of particular topics. Imperialism and the Matrix. From the time of Columbus to 1945, world affairs were largely dominated by competition among Western nations seeking to stake out spheres of influence, control sea lanes, and exploit colonial empires. Each Western power became the core of an imperialist economy whose periphery was managed for the benefit of the core nation. Military might determined the scope of an empire. Wars were initiated when a core nation felt it had sufficient power to expand its periphery at the expense of a competitor. Economies and societies in the periphery were kept backward to keep their populations under control, to provide cheap labor, and to guarantee markets for goods manufactured at the core. Imperialism robbed the periphery not only of wealth, but also of its ability to develop its own societies, cultures, and economies in a natural way for local benefit. The driving force behind Western imperialism has always been the pursuit of economic gain, ever since Isabella commissioned Columbus on his first entrepreneurial voyage. The rhetoric of empire concerning wars, however, has typically been about other things. The white man's burden, bringing true religion to the heathens, manifest destiny, defeating the yellow peril or the Hun, seeking Laban's realm or making the world safe for democracy. Any fabricated motivation for war or empire would do as long as it appealed to the collective consciousness of the population at the time. The propaganda lies of yesterday were recorded and became consensus history, the fabric of the Matrix. While the costs of territorial empire, fleets, colonial administrations, etc., were borne by Western taxpayers generally, the profits of imperialism were enjoyed primarily by private corporations and investors. Government and corporate elites were partners in the business of imperialism. Empires gave government leaders power and prestige, and gave corporate leaders power and wealth. Corporations ran the real business of empire while government leaders fabricated noble excuses for the wars that were required to keep that business going. Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics.
641.
As with Serbia, and more recently Libya, events in Haiti were sold to the public as humanitarian intervention. This technique has long been used as a justification for imperialism. Originally, the idea was to civilize the savages, then to promote what was termed democracy. In the early 20th century, General Smedley Butler described with remarkable candor his actual role in the U.S. Army. "I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefits of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see to it that Standard Oil went its way unmolested." Butler summed up his message with four simple words: "War is a racket."
656.
We switched into a more subtle phase of the ancient Monroe Doctrine, where instead of using Marines so much with gunboat diplomacy, we created a National Guard with officers trained at our academies here in the States. and then maintain control of the country by proxy without taking the heat for having our troops inside the country itself. It's been said that this event was the birth of neocolonialism. This also was the kickoff of the U.S. policy of establishing a military oligarchy. We set up schools and trained tens of thousands of military and police officers in countries all over Latin America and Africa in some cases, and Asia, putting them through our academies, arming them, paying their salaries afterwards, trying to create and successfully creating a situation where we would have a fraternity of people in these countries in power who were more loyal to the fraternity of our own military than they were to the peasants and people of their own countries. Meanwhile, this cat-and-mouse game that we've played with Nicaragua since 1981 is a classic case of what CIA directors more recently themselves called destabilization. The point is to put pressure on the targeted government by ripping apart the social and economic fabric of the country. Now, that's words, you know, social and economic fabric. That means making the people suffer as much as you can until the country plunges into chaos, until at some point you can step in and impose your choice of governments on that country. The rationales we've used in Nicaragua are classic. We've been fighting communism. It's been national security. They're a Marxist bastion in our own backyard and all of that.
Matrix reality was about patriotism, national honor, and heroic causes. True reality was on another plane altogether, that of economics. Industrialization, beginning in the late 1700s, created a demand for new markets and increased raw materials. Both demands spurred accelerated expansion of empire. Wealthy investors amassed fortunes by setting up large-scale industrial and trading operations, leading to the emergence of an influential capitalist elite. Like any other elite, capitalists used their wealth and influence to further their own interests however they could. And the interests of capitalism always come down to economic growth. Investors must reap more than they sow, or the whole system comes to a grinding halt. Thus, capitalism, industrialization, nationalism, warfare, imperialism, and the Matrix co-evolved. Industrialized weapon production provided the muscle of modern warfare, and capitalism provided the appetite to use that muscle. Government leaders pursued the politics necessary to expand empire while creating a rhetorical matrix around nationalism to justify those policies. Capitalist growth depended on empire, which in turn depended on a strong and stable core nation to defend it. National interests and capitalist interests were inextricably linked, or so it seemed, for more than two centuries.
640.
Well, Grand Area Strategy was developed really during the Second World War, and it continued to develop afterwards in the early stages of the Cold War. This is grand kind of world order planning, and most of the evidence that we have for this and the direction it took came out of the Council on Foreign Relations working group that was set up in the 1940s with the State Department called the War and Peace Studies Project. And most of this material is now declassified and available. The documents that have come out really reveal a very kind of imperial, openly imperial mindset. I mean, there was the language spoke openly about establishing a Pax Americana. It talked about the necessity of transitioning away from British imperial rule to a new form of American global domination. It openly talked about limiting the sovereignty of different countries depending on their amenability to the principles of this new global economic and political order that the United States and Britain envisaged. It spoke about the need to establish international institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF and the United Nations as mechanisms to regulate this world order, but quite openly spoke about doing this in the interests of the advanced industrial countries such as Britain, the United States and Western Europe. So on the one hand, even though there was this sense of benevolence, there was this idea that if we don't set up these institutions, there will be this international stability and there will be this danger of Nazism. There was also this quite candid admission it would protect the economic interests of a specific group of states and the interests of the colonies themselves and the kind of these countries in the less developed world that were trying to breaking out at this time, kind of struggling for national independence, that their interests were really not in the equation. And there were even references to the need to use propaganda to legitimize this whole new structure to domestic publics.
I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000, continuing. World War II and Pax Americana. 1945 will be remembered as a year World War II ended and the bond of the atomic nucleus was broken. But 1945 also marked another momentous fission, the breaking of the bond between national and capitalist interests. After every previous war, and in many cases after severe devastation, European nations had always picked themselves back up and resumed their competition over empire. But after World War II, a Pax Americana was established. The U.S. began to manage all the Western peripheries on behalf of capitalism generally, while preventing the communist powers from interfering in the game. Capitalist powers no longer needed to fight over investment realms, and competitive imperialism was replaced by collective imperialism. Opportunities for capital growth were no longer linked to the military power of nations apart from the power of America. In his Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, William Blum chronicles hundreds of significant covert and overt interventions, showing exactly how the U.S. carried out its imperial management role.
On September 11, 1973, the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown in a violent coup d'etat. It established a military dictatorship run by Auguste Pinochet, which would last for 17 years, resulting in the torture and murder of thousands of citizens.
U.S. National Security Advisor, 1969-73.
Had no contact with any of the people that carried out the military coup, and therefore the coup that overthrew Allende was done without contact with the United States.
Kissinger was lying. Declassified documents reveal that the coup in Chile was directed from Washington, and that the Allende regime had been under attack even before its inception. A CIA cable of October 1970 reads, "It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown in a coup." In stark contrast to what Allende had in mind as a corrective to Chile's economic woes, Pinochet would embrace a radical program of free market forms as theorized by economist Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys. Friedman described himself as a libertarian with a small L, presenting his philosophy as a more moderate variant of the Austrian school of free market capitalism. He shared with them a vision in which virtually everything is owned. The programs entailed deregulation, wage reduction, attacks against unions, elimination of social spending, and a fire sale of natural resources to transnational corporations. The Western press described the events in Chile as an economic miracle.
In the post-war years, Matrix reality diverged ever further from actual reality. In the post-war Matrix world, imperialism had been abandoned, and the world was being, quote, democratized. In the real world, imperialism had become better organized and more efficient. In the Matrix world, the U.S., quote, restored order, or, quote, came to the assistance of nations which were being, quote, undermined by Soviet influence, unquote. In the real world, the periphery was being systematically suppressed and exploited. In the Matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery.
From episode 4.
Yeah, if you take a look at these ads here, which are targeted at U.S. companies to convince them to go offshore to access the low wages in El Salvador or other countries, you'll see the wage 57 cents an hour if you would go offshore. A year later, the wages are down to 33 cents an hour. This is the corporate agenda. And a part of that corporate agenda is to pit young workers in the Third World against workers in the United States. We're pitted against each other in a race to the bottom. Who will accept the lowest wages? Who will accept the least benefits? Who will accept the most miserable working conditions? This is a plan. The women in El Salvador get paid 12 cents for each $20 Gap t-shirt. We have a very important question to ask. What has happened to the $19.88? Where has that disappeared to since the workers only keep 12 cents out of the shirt?
Under recent Republican administrations, the U.S. Agency for International Development has funneled well over $1 billion of taxpayers' money into creating the free trade zones. In these protected areas, corporations import materials duty-free and export the finished garments to the U.S. at special reduced tariffs. They pay no corporate taxes, no income taxes, little or no social security or health benefits, and they treat their workers like slaves. There are no inspections, no regulations, and when workers try to organize, they are fired.
In the Matrix world, the benefit was going to the periphery in the form of countless aid programs. In the real world, immense wealth was being extracted from the periphery. Growing glitches in the Matrix weren't noticed by most people in the West because the post-war years brought unprecedented levels of Western prosperity and social progress. The rhetoric claimed progress would come to all, and Westerners could see it being realized in their own towns and cities. The West became the collective core of a global empire, and exploitative development led to prosperity for Western populations, while generating immense riches for corporations, banks, and wealthy capital investors. Glitches in the Matrix, Popular Rebellion, and Neoliberalism. The parallel agenda of Third World exploitation and Western prosperity worked effectively for the first two post-war decades. But in the 1960s, large numbers of Westerners, particularly the young and well-educated, began to notice glitches in the Matrix. In Vietnam, imperialism was too naked to be successfully masked as something else. A major split in American public consciousness occurred as millions of anti-war protesters and civil rights activists punctured the fabricated consensus of the 1950s and declared the reality of exploitation and suppression, both at home and abroad. The environmental movement arose, challenging even the exploitation of the natural world. In Europe, 1968 joined 1848 as a landmark year of popular protest. These developments disturbed elite planners. The post-war regime's stability was being challenged from within the core, and the formula of Western prosperity no longer guaranteed public passivity. A report published in 1975, the report of the Trilateral Task Force on Governability of Democracies, provides a glimpse into the thinking of elite circles. Alan Wolfe discusses this report in Holly Sklar's eye-opening work, Trilateralism. Wolfe focuses especially on the analysis Harvard professor Samuel P. Huntington presented in a section of the report entitled The Crisis of Democracy. Huntington is an articulate promoter of elite policy shifts and contributes pivotal articles to publications such as the Council on Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs. Huntington tells us that democratic societies cannot work, quote-unquote, unless the citizenry is, quote, passive. The, quote, democratic surge of the 1960s represented an, quote, excess of democracy, which must be reduced if governments are to carry out their traditional domestic and foreign policies. Huntington's notion of traditional policies is expressed in a passage from the report, quote, "To the extent that the United States was governed by anyone during the decades after World War II, it was governed by the president acting with the support and cooperation of key individuals and groups in the executive office, the federal bureaucracy, Congress, and the more important businesses, banks, law firms, foundations, and media, which constitute the private sector's establishment." Close quote. In these few words, Huntington spells out the reality that electoral democracy has little to do with how America is run, and summarizes the kind of people who are included within the elite planning community. Who needs conspiracy theories when elite machinations are clearly described in public documents like these? Besides failing to deliver popular passivity, the policy of prosperity for Western populations had another downside, having to do with Japan's economic success. Under the Pax Americana umbrella, Japan had been able to industrialize and become an imperial player. The prohibition on Japanese rearmament had become irrelevant. With Japan's then lower living standards, Japanese producers could undercut prevailing prices and steal market share from Western producers.
749.
And then this lovely 30-year period, 1945 to 75, came to an end. The Europeans had the bad taste to rebuild their economies. The Japanese, equally, the bad taste to rebuild their economies. And, of course, being capitalist economies, they knew who they had to beat. They had to beat the United States. They had to produce what the United States produced, either better quality or a cheaper price, or best of all, both. Otherwise, they'd have no chance. In a world dominated by the United States, militarily, politically, culturally, if you're going to succeed as a capitalist in Japan or Germany or anywhere else, you better outdo the Americans. So they set themselves to do that, and by and large, they did. So by the 1970s, Americans were trading in their Fords and Chevys and buying VWs and eventually Hondas, and you know the rest. The United States could no longer get away with the game for those first 30 years. It had to change the game, and the 1970s was the time when the game got changed. And the basic change of the game was no more wage increases. We're going to compete with these foreigners, and we're going to do it by taking it out on you, the American working class.
623.
Profits were, had not decreased, but certainly flattened out in the late 1970s. And corporations definitely wanted a state regime, a policy regime more amenable to them. And as neoliberalism came in the early 1980s, you see corporate profits indeed increasing excruciatingly quickly. Yes, corporations had a lower rate of profit. It doesn't give them the right to then completely change the society, especially a society that was for a while giving decent incomes to poor people just because they, weren't making so much profit.
Richard Peet is professor of geography at Clark University. And his books include Unholy Trinity, the IMF, World Bank, and WTO, and Geography of Power, the Making of Global Economic Policy.
Western capital needed to find a way to become more competitive on world markets, and Western prosperity was standing in the way. Elite strategists, as Huntington showed, were fully capable of understanding these considerations, and the requirements of corporate growth created a strong motivation to make the needed adjustments in both reality and rhetoric. If popular prosperity could be sacrificed, there were many obvious ways Western capital could be made more competitive. Production could be moved overseas to low-wage areas, allowing domestic unemployment to rise. Unions could be attacked and wages forced down, and people could be pushed into temporary and part-time jobs without benefits. Regulations governing corporate behavior could be removed. Corporate and capital gains taxes could be reduced, and the revenue losses could be taken out of public service budgets. Public infrastructures could be privatized, the services reduced to cut costs, and then they could be milked for easy profits when they deteriorated from neglect. These are the very policies and programs launched during the Reagan-Thatcher years in the U.S. and Britain. They represent a systematic project of increasing corporate growth at the expense of popular prosperity and welfare. Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization. But around them was woven an economic mythology.
629.
For some economists who were involved in this story, there is a further question. Were their theories used to disguise political policies that would otherwise have been very difficult to implement in Britain?
The nightmare I sometimes have about this whole experience runs as follows. I was involved in making a number of proposals which were partly at least adopted by the government and put in play by the government. Now, my worry is as follows, that there may have been people making the actual policy decisions, or people behind them, who never believed for a moment that this was the correct way to bring down inflation. They did, however, see that it would be a very, very good way to raise unemployment. And raising unemployment was an extremely desirable way of reducing the strength of the working classes, if you like, that what was engineered there, in Marx's terms, was a crisis of capitalism which recreated reserve army of labour and has allowed the capitalists to make high profits ever since. Now, again, I don't say I believe that story, but when I really worry about all this, I worry whether, indeed, that was really what was going on.
595.
The first was rapid and radical changes imposed from the top by neoliberal politicians and bureaucrats, justified by a real or manufactured crisis. Controls over financial transactions were abolished, publicly owned corporations privatized, trade unions were weakened or destroyed by labour market deregulation, wages and welfare cut. The second phase was one of consolidation, led by massive tax cuts, limiting future government initiatives, and leading to further cuts in public services and the power of government. Over a period of time, people's expectations of their governments were expected to diminish as they adjusted to the new reality. It had been anticipated by New Zealand's New Right revolutionaries that by the early 2000s, our values would have changed and we would have come to think like them, accepting poverty and extreme wealth as both normal and necessary, to pursue personal advantage and to care less about our neighbours. But studies show that in fact our values haven't changed much from those of our parents and grandparents. What is happening, though, is that we are forgetting how things used to be and who changed them. Even as the human and environmental costs of the neoliberal experiment increase, we are finding it harder and harder to imagine how things could be better.
Such a real agenda would have been unpopular, and a corresponding matrix reality was fabricated for public consumption. The matrix reality used terms like deregulation, reduced taxes, and privatization, but around them was woven an economic mythology. The old, failed, laissez-faire doctrine of the 1800s was reintroduced with the help of Milton Friedman's Chicago School of Economics, and less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain.
The view that they were proposing was really that markets do know best, and that markets are places where private agents pursue private welfare, private benefit, private profit, with all the incentives that go with that. They saw markets as being enormously creative, enormously powerful allocative devices, but also better at making social judgments, better at shaping society than human agencies. And there was a real unwillingness to go back and revisit the origins of the welfare state in New Zealand, to think about why New Zealanders had come to do things the way they did. And because of the lack of historical understanding and the lack of historical depth in the work and thinking of these economists, their work really did come very directly from a single theoretical preconceived position.
The idea that markets know best coincided with right-wing economic theories popular in American universities at the time and practiced by the conservative Reagan and Thatcher administrations. It also fitted well with right-wing attitudes about increasing individual freedom and reducing elected authority. Altogether, these ideas became known as the ideology of the New Right.
And less government became the proud modern theme in America and Britain. Sensible regulations had restored financial stability after the Great Depression and had broken up anti-competitive monopolies such as the Rockefeller Trust and AT&T. But in the new matrix reality, all regulations were considered bureaucratic interference. Reagan and Thatcher preached the virtues of individualism and promised to, quote, get government off people's backs, unquote. The implication was that everyday individuals were to get more money and freedom, but in reality, the primary benefits would go to corporations and wealthy investors. The academic term for laissez-faire economics is economic liberalism, and hence the Reagan-Thatcher revolution has come to be known as the neoliberal revolution. It brought a radical change in actual reality by returning to the economic philosophy that led to sweatshops, corruption, and robber baron monopolies in the 19th century. It brought an equally radical change in matrix reality, a complete reversal in the attitude that was projected regarding government. Government policies had always been criticized in the media, but the institution of government had always been respected, reflecting the traditional bond between capitalism and nationalism. With Reagan, we had a sitting president telling us that government itself was a bad thing. Many of us may have agreed with him, but such a sentiment had never before found official favor. Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process.
That removed our national bargaining structures that were in place at the time. Most workers in the workforce were covered by a document that was negotiated nationally between unions and employers and set down the basic minimums that they were entitled to at work. And that included things, basic things that you would call human rights, I guess, like lunch breaks, tea breaks, health and safety procedures, personal grievance procedures, wage rates, all those sorts of things that workers are generally come to accept as entitlements when they took a job. And it put workers on their own and gave the employer ultimate power to set those wages and conditions.
Soon, British and American populations were beginning to applaud the destruction of the very democratic institutions that provided their only hope of participation in the political process. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. Continuing. Globalization and World Government. The essential bond between capitalism and nationalism was broken in 1945, but it took some time for elite planners to recognize this new condition and to begin bringing the world system into alignment with it. The strong Western nation-state had been the bulwark of capitalism for centuries, and initial post-war policies were based on the assumption that this would continue indefinitely. The Bretton Woods financial system, the IMF, World Bank, and a system of fixed exchange rates among major currencies was set up to stabilize national economies, and popular prosperity was encouraged to provide political stability. Neoliberalism in the U.S. and Britain represented the first serious break with this policy framework and brought the first visible signs of the fission of the nation-capital bond. The neoliberal project was economically profitable in the U.S. and Britain, and the public accepted the matrix economic mythology. Meanwhile, the integrated global economy gave rise to a new generation of transnational corporations, and corporate leaders began to realize that corporate growth was not dependent on a strong core nation state.
656.
The arms race is breaking the economies of both of the superpowers. The multinational defense corporations have no great loyalty to the United States. They are no longer U.S. corporations. They make enormous profits and invest the money overseas. They are quite willing to sell the U.S. economy down the drain in order to make their profits.
Indeed, Western nations, with their environmental laws, consumer protection measures, and other forms of regulatory interference, were a burden on corporate growth. Having been successfully field-tested in the two oldest, quote-unquote, democracies, the neoliberal project moved onto the global stage. the Bretton Woods system of fixed rates of currency exchange was weakened, and the international financial system became destabilizing instead of stabilizing for national economies. The radical free trade project was launched, leading eventually to the World Trade Organization. The fission that had begun in 1945 was finally manifesting as an explosive change in the world system. The objective of neoliberal free trade treaties is to remove all political controls over domestic and international trade and commerce. Corporations have free rein to maximize profits, heedless of environmental consequences and safety risks. Instead of governments regulating corporations, the WTO now sets rules for governments, telling them what kind of beef they must import, whether or not they can ban asbestos, and what additives they must permit in petroleum products. So far, in every case where the WTO has been asked to review a health, safety, or environmental regulation, the regulation has been overturned. Most of the world has been turned into a periphery. The imperial core has boiled down to the capitalist elite themselves, represented by their bureaucratic, unrepresentative WTO world government. The burden of accelerated imperialism falls hardest outside the West, where loans are used as a lever by the IMF to compel debtor nations such as Rwanda and South Korea to accept suicidal, quote, reform packages. In the 1800s, genocide was employed to clear North America and Australia of their native populations, creating room for growth. Today, a similar program of genocide has apparently been unleashed against sub-Saharan Africa. The IMF destroys the economies. The CIA trains militias and stirs up tribal conflicts. And the West sells weapons to all sides. Famine and genocidal civil wars are the predictable and inevitable result. Meanwhile, AIDS runs rampant while the WTO and the U.S. government use trade laws to prevent medicines from reaching the victims. As in the past, Western military force will be required to control the non-Western periphery and make adjustments to local political arrangements when considered necessary by elite planners. The Pentagon continues to provide the primary policing power, with NATO playing an ever-increasing role. Resentment against the West and against neoliberalism is growing in the Third World, and the frequency of military interventions is bound to increase. All of this needs to be made acceptable to Western minds, adding a new dimension to the Matrix. In the latest Matrix reality, the West is called the international community, whose goal is to serve humanitarian causes. Bill Clinton made it explicit with his Clinton Doctrine, in which, as quoted in the Washington Post, he solemnly promised, quote, "If somebody comes after innocent civilians and tries to kill them en masse because of their race, their ethnic background, or their religion, and it is within our power to stop it, we will stop it," close quote. This matrix fabrication is very effective indeed. Who opposes prevention of genocide? Only outside the matrix does one see that genocide is caused by the West in the first place, and that the worst cases of genocide are continuing, that assistance usually makes things worse, as in the Balkans, and that Clinton's handy doctrine enables him to intervene when and where he chooses, since dictators and the stirring of ethnic rivalries are standard tools in managing the periphery. A U.S. president can always find, quote, innocent civilians, wherever elite plans call for an intervention.
A useful summary from episode 304.
The first way that the target regime comes to the attention of the United States, the first way that we begin to look at this country and think of it as a problem, is as a result of complaints from American businesses. It's when nationalist regimes begin to challenge the right of foreign companies to operate as they wish that they first get into trouble with the United States. That's step one. The next step is when the officials of these companies go to their friends in Washington and explain what the problem is. And they say, government of country X is forcing us to obey environmental laws, they're forcing us to pay minimum wage, they're forcing us to pay export taxes, whatever the problem is, they complain bitterly about this, and they ask for redress. Now, the leaders of the U.S. government do not intervene abroad directly to protect or reestablish the interests of corporations. What they do is they take these complaints and they rephrase them and reshape them so that the threat posed by that foreign country is seen not as economic but as geostrategic and political. The argument is that if a country is not going to allow an American company to operate as it wishes, that country must be cruel, repressive, dictatorial, unfair, anti-American, and probably a tool of some very big power that is working assiduously to undermine American interests. Therefore, it is in our strategic and political interests to intervene there and overthrow the government. That's part two. But there's a third way that the motivation morphs, and that is when it becomes time for American leaders to explain to the public why we are carrying out this operation. That's when a third argument takes over. It's the argument that is beautifully calculated to appeal to the very innocent and compassionate souls of most Americans. The argument is, we are not going there to take anything. We are not going there to harm anyone. We are only going there to help. We Americans have developed a society that is so successful. We have freedom. We have prosperity. Not only do we have the right, but maybe Providence has even given us the responsibility, the duty to go to other countries and share our goodness, our benefits with those poor people who don't even realize how much they want to be governed on systems like ours. They don't even know how good it is to be in a free democracy like ours. So we're going to go over there and we're going to give them that democracy, even if they don't realize how much they want it. Americans really are, I think, a very compassionate people. And when you combine that with our general ignorance of the world, you can see how successful this argument is. It appeals to something that's very deep in the American spirit.
In Matrix reality, globalization is not a project, but rather the inevitable result of beneficial market forces. Genocide in Africa is no fault of the West, but is due to ancient tribal rivalries. Every measure demanded by globalization is referred to as reform. The word is never used with irony. Democracy and reform are frequently used together, always leaving the subtle impression that one has something to do with the other. The illusion is presented that all economic boats are rising, and if yours isn't, it must be your own fault. You aren't competitive enough. Economic failures are explained away as temporary adjustments, or else the victim, as in South Korea or Russia, is blamed for not being sufficiently neoliberal. Investor confidence is referred to with the same awe and reverence that earlier societies might have expressed towards the will of the gods. The Western quality of life continues to decline, while the WTO establishes legal precedents ensuring that its authority will not be challenged when its decisions become more draconian. Things will get much worse in the West. This was anticipated in elite circles when the neoliberal project was still on the drawing board, as is illustrated in Samuel Huntington's The Crisis of Democracy report discussed earlier. The management of discontented societies. The post-war years, especially in the United States, were characterized by consensus politics. Most people shared a common understanding of how society worked and generally approved of how things were going. Prosperity was real, and the Matrix version of reality was reassuring. Most people believed in it. Those beliefs became a shared consensus, and the government could then carry out its plans as intended responding to the programmed public will. The excess democracy of the 1960s and 1970s attacked this shared consensus from below, and neoliberal planners decided from above that ongoing consensus wasn't worth paying for. They accepted that segments of society would persist in disbelieving various parts of the matrix. Activism and protest were to be expected. New means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent.
618.
What we're looking at here in general is a dialectic between the military and corporate elite consolidated in the interests of maintaining the capitalist ship of state, so to speak, maintaining the profits and privileges of the elite in this country against the great majority of the American people. So you have Pentagon, Congressional in lockstep around this whole question of militarization of law enforcement. The Council on Foreign Relations, an elite policymaker headquartered in New York City. In 1995, the Independent Task Force on Non-Lethal Weapons of the Council on Foreign Relations issued a report which stressed the need to assess the current status of non-lethal weapons development, advocating the increased and research and development at the Pentagon in the area of so-called non-lethal weapons, which are weapons designed to suppress dissent, suppress civilian protest, and so forth.
Who was its director, and what was he well known for?
The director of the CFR task force was a gentleman by the name of W. Montague Winfield. Brigadier General Winfield was, along with chairing this independent task force on non-lethal weapons, was the deputy director for operations in the National Military Command Center at the Pentagon on the morning of 9/11. He was the person who, according to the 9/11 commission, left his very important post at the National Military Command Center. Remember, there was this whole story about this lack of communication and the pilots didn't know where they were going and it's all this chaos. Well, he's the guy who left his post that very morning to attend a so-called pre-scheduled meeting and allowed a colleague who had only recently qualified to take over his position and standing in for him. And he didn't return to his post until after the so-called attacks had ended. There you have another example of this close collaborative relationship between the military and the Pentagon, not only in the area of non-lethal weapons, but as pointed out here in the machinations of 9/11.
New means of social control would be needed to deal with activist movements and with growing discontent, as neoliberalism gradually tightened the economic screws. Such means of control were identified and have since been largely implemented, particularly in the United States.
What is the May 17th, 2012 Department of Defense Instruction 3200.19 entitled Non-Lethal Weapons Human Effects Characterization?
Basically, what it does is it attempts to scientifically calibrate levels and quotients of pain and suffering.
In many ways, America sets the pace of globalization. Innovations can often be observed there before they occur elsewhere. This is particularly true in the case of social control techniques. The most obvious means of social control in a discontented society is a strong, semi-militarized police force. Most of the periphery had been managed by such means for centuries. This was obvious to elite planners in the West, was adopted as policy, and has now been largely implemented. Urban and suburban ghettos, where the adverse consequences of neoliberalism are currently most concentrated, have literally become occupied territories where police beatings and unjustified shootings are commonplace. So that the beefed-up police force could maintain control in conditions of mass unrest, elite planners also realized that much of the Bill of Rights would need to be neutralized. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government.
When Jefferson and Madison were putting together the Bill of Rights, what they wanted to do was build an absolute wall between government, which could live forever and could accumulate power and could potentially one day oppress its citizens because they had just overthrown such a government, between government on the one hand and the rights of individual citizens on the other hand. So they wanted to give this enormous club to the citizens so that they could beat back government if it ever became oppressive. And that club is the right of assembly, the right of free speech, the right not to incriminate yourself, the right to a trial by your peers, the right to privacy, and you know, the right against discrimination, which was passed after the Civil War, and what we call the Bill of Rights, you know, and the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Let me say that again. This is not surprising, given that the bill's authors had just lived through a revolution and were seeking to ensure that future generations would have the means to organize and overthrow any oppressive future government. The Rights Neutralization Project has been largely implemented, as exemplified by armed midnight raids, outrageous search and seizure practices, overly broad conspiracy laws, wholesale invasion of privacy, massive incarceration, and the rise of prison slave labor.
16.
To quote from a Corrections Corporation of America business prospectus sent over the internet in January 1999, prison-based industry offers several advantages, including a plentiful labor force, low operating costs, and available space. The plentiful labor force, or as some corporate executives are calling them, raw materials, are the increasing numbers of men and women transferred into the private prisons. The low operating costs are the literal slave wage pennies paid to the labor force, the inmates. Giant corporations like IBM, Nike, and Wilson Sporting Goods are beginning to see the benefits of private prison industrialization. Many such companies are starting to relocate manufacturing plants out of third world nations and placing them into private prisons around the country. Once there, these corporations can legally pay the labor force anywhere from 17 cents to a dollar and a quarter per hour to make their products. They also reduce their costs of overseas shipping. As Oregon State Representative Kevin Mannix said to Nike officials when encouraging them to relocate production from Indonesia to his home state, "Take a look at the transportation and labor costs. We can offer competitive prison labor here."
The Rubicon has been crossed. The techniques of oppression long common in the empire's periphery are being imported to the core.
672.
The organization which says, for example, how many automatic machine guns, how many automatic weapons the police are going to have, or whether they're going to use tasers or whether they're going to use shotgun tasers, all those policy decisions are being made by ACPO.
ACPO level.
And ACPO is a private company.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned earlier in the program that we have another private company called Kroll that's able to exert extraordinary influence over our police force.
And their chairman is here advising the Home Office as we speak now on policing matters.
In The Matrix, the genre of the TV or movie police drama has served to create a reality in which rights are a joke, the accused are despicable sociopaths, and no criminal is ever brought to justice until some noble cop or prosecutor bends the rules a bit. Government officials bolster the construct by declaring wars on crime and drugs, and noble cops are fighting a war out there in the streets, and you can't win a war without using your enemy's dirty tricks. The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied.
Yes, I am alleging that the CIA is involved in high-level drug trafficking. You may ask yourself, why then, in Wikipedia, does their page only refer to allegations of CIA drug trafficking? Well, let's hear from LAPD narcotics investigator turned whistleblower Mike Rupert speaking in episode 23.
Gary Webb's fabulous book, Dark Alliance, goes further than any other toward really documenting direct CIA involvement. Well, a number of investigations were started as a result of that. and as a result of my confrontation with John Deutsch. Now, these are excerpts which I publish, but the report from which these excerpts come is a CIA report. And I have a huge website, and those of you who want to write it down, it's www.copvcia.com, C-O-P-V-C-I-A.com. And you can link directly to the CIA report, which is about 460 pages. But I have pulled these 60 pages out of that report, and I've made my editorial comments, but these are the CIA's own words. In their report, which was released on October the 8th of 1998, the CIA admits that it, throughout the course of the Contra War, it dealt with 58 known narcotics traffickers. It admits that it kept six of them out of jail. It admits that it deliberately lied to the United States Congress about the role of drug trafficking played by its assets and employees during the Contra War. It admits that it briefed Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush on how it was lying to Congress about trafficking by its agents and employees and assets on a regular basis, and that Vice President Bush approved. It admits page after page after page, but let me just read you one little example, okay, when we talk about proof. Paragraph 490 talks about a guy named Moises Nunez, okay? He was a CIA contractor, in essence. He was on a State Department subsidy. The poor guy wasn't making enough moving 200 kilos of cocaine a week, so the State Department had to give him a little extra to supply humanitarian aid to the Contras. And he was caught with 200 kilos of cocaine and taken into custody, and the CIA talked to him, and they wrote here, he says that Nunez revealed that since 1985 he had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. That's the White House that oversees the CIA. That's Oliver North, okay? He had engaged in a clandestine relationship with the National Security Council. Nunez refused to elaborate on the nature of these actions, but indicated it was difficult to answer questions relating to his involvement in narcotics trafficking because of the specific tasks he had performed at the direction of the NSC. In other words, he's dealing the cocaine for the White House. It's right here, CIA's own report. Okay? In the next paragraph, CIA says, well, we didn't know what to do with this guy, but it says, the next day, however, a headquarters cable stated that headquarters had decided against debriefing Nunez. Don't ask him any more questions. Direct cable from CIA to the field. Page after page. A company called Setco, moving 4 tons of cocaine a month, owned by Juan Ramon Mara Ballesteros in Honduras, was using bank accounts that were opened by Oliver North. It's right here in the CIA's report. Now, let me read you the most stunning part of this. This is the actual letter. It's a memorandum. In 1981, Ronald Reagan's director of Central Intelligence and the U.S. Department of Justice began a series of negotiations because it's a law under U.S. code that a government agency must report crimes by its employees. But yet they started a whole new series of negotiations under Reagan, and they suddenly took, at CIA, the highest level on the food chain is a case officer. That's a card-carrying, badge-carrying CIA guy who can't be disavowed if he's caught or captured. Beneath that, they have career agents, they have contract agents, they have informants, they have contract employees, they have all these other things. And they entered into this negotiations, and they suddenly said, everybody who's not a case officer at CIA is no longer an employee under the law. These are people who were going to get pensions from CIA. Let me read you this letter dated, just one paragraph, dated February 11th, 1982. It's addressed to the Honorable William J. Casey, Director of Central Intelligence, signed by William French Smith, Ronald Reagan's Attorney General. It says, in light of these provisions and in view of the fine cooperation the Drug Enforcement Administration, shall we make comment on that, has received from CIA, no formal requirement regarding the reporting of narcotics violations has been included in these procedures. By the stroke of a pen, this is the smoking gun document, the U.S. Department of Justice told the CIA that there was no need to report drug trafficking by its employees. Now, if I say to you that we have a criminal government, maybe I will make some sense to you. I hope so. It's clear. It's as clear as the nose on my face. It's as clear as the nose on everybody's face right here, okay? We have a criminal government that is engaged in criminal activity. Why do we act sometimes as if we're dealing with someone that has perfect legitimacy, but we have to work within the system?
I think that's a very important question by Mike Rupert, and one that bears further reflection upon. I think it was Martin Luther King said something approximating to the sentiment that people do not easily speak out against their government. He was criticizing the Vietnam War, and he felt that on his part, silence would be betrayal, that he had to speak out. I think increasingly many people are actually following that, not because they are crazy, more because it's increasingly well understood. In the 21st century, citizens, compared to before, have an ever wider ability to share information with others and to discuss things through the internet, and the understanding that mendacity at the highest levels, far from being the result of bad apples, has become absolutely routine, that is forcing people to speak out. I'm going to suggest that cooperating with a system which is hard at work destroying the biosphere, cutting down trees, pulling fish out of the oceans, poisoning the environment, is not something that we should do lightly, and that there are certainly alternatives. And, well, that's one reason why I'm making this audio, to try and share my opinions, to give them a wider audience, because I'm sick and tired of the lies that are peddled through corporate media. Some more thanks are in order to the good people at GNN, that's Guerrilla News Network, who made and put online the following interview with Gary Webb, which I saw way back when, and helped me to see the bigger picture that, yes, the CIA were dealing drugs, and of course, all that money helped them cover it up. And this is something we broadcast in episode 592.
Investigative reporting is being sort of squeezed out of the picture, and I think intentionally, because it tends to ruffle feathers. I mean, good investigative reporting does ruffle feathers, and it draws lawsuits, and it gets newspapers in trouble.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ship.
My name is Gary Webb. I am an investigative journalist. I've been an investigative journalist for about 25 years for daily newspapers. And in 1996, I wrote a series of stories entitled Dark Alliance, which was about CIA involvement in drug trafficking. What my story showed was that the cocaine that was being sold in those neighborhoods was coming from mainly one source, and this one source was being used to finance a guerrilla war in Central America. The general idea of the CIA dealing drugs was something that the American mainstream press had never written about before, and that's why it prompted outrage among blacks, among drug reform activists, among politicians, by the CIA, by every federal agency involved in the drug war, because it showed they weren't doing their jobs, that it was a fraud. Right after we published the stories, the support we got from the media was very favorable. Newsweek magazine did a big piece on the story and said it was well documented and well researched. The website was getting like a million hits a day. There were marches in Watts, there were marches in Compton, there were candlelight vigils. Every California senator demanded an official investigation. So the story itself was really building momentum. The government reaction was no reaction. And this, I believe, was a very careful strategy, because nobody was going to believe the government if they came out and said we didn't do it. The proof was fairly overwhelming, since we had all these government documents showing that it had happened. So what happened was they let the so-called liberal press speak for them. And they had the national security reporters at the Washington Post, who coincidentally used to work for the CIA, write stories saying it doesn't mean anything. It was a distraction from what the story said, and it became sort of a media war between the Mercury News, which stood behind the story at that point, and the rest of the establishment media who wanted us to back away from it. And part of that reason was because these major newspapers had written about this issue back in the 1980s, but had written about it very dismissively, as if this is nonsense, it doesn't happen, it never happened. And then 10 years later, we came back with documentation showing that it was absolutely true and that it was worse than we thought. We had gotten a story out around them, and we had gotten it out in a big way that they couldn't control, and that was through the internet. And I think a lot of this was directed to the Mercury News to say, we don't care what documentation you have, we don't care what kind of story you've got, we set the national news agenda. And if we don't like your story, we will kill your story, regardless of its truth. The media rejoiced when this came out, because it meant they had won. They had forced a newspaper to back away from a story that was true, simply because of this barrage of criticism, of mindless criticism, essentially, that really took its toll on the editors of the newspaper. And they were being seen as sort of outcasts from the club. And I think they made a political decision that it was better in the long run to take a dive on this story and get back in the good graces of the rest of the media. It was essentially a war between my editors and myself, because I wouldn't apologize for the story or back away from the story, and fought them on it publicly. And so they transferred me to a bureau that was 140 miles from where I lived, and I called in sick a lot. One of the things I'm proudest of in regards to that story is the website that the Mercury News set up, because it really was the first time that a newspaper brought its readers not only into the interior of the paper, but into the reporters' notebooks. You know, this was a story that, as I told my editors, had a very high unbelievability factor built into it. A lot of people were going to say, this can't be true. And this story became a sensation because of the website. Not because of the story, but because people could get to it. And they could never have gotten to it before, because the San Jose Mercury News is a small regional newspaper in Northern California that you couldn't read if you lived in New York, or you couldn't read if you lived in LA. But this story you could read anywhere in the world and see all of our documentation. So it became, and we did this on purpose, to make it very hard to knock down, to make it very difficult for people to say this didn't happen. But they said it didn't happen anyway.
The CIA plays its role by managing the international drug trade and making sure that ghetto drug dealers are well supplied. In this way, the American public has been led to accept the means of its own suppression. The mechanisms of the police state are in place. They will be used when necessary, as we see in ghettos and skyrocketing prison populations, as we saw on the streets of Seattle and Washington, D.C. during recent anti-WTO demonstrations, and as is suggested by executive orders that enable the president to suspend the Constitution and declare martial law whenever he deems it necessary.
535.
Continuity of government planning, the process by which the U.S. Constitution has already been superseded. In July 1987, during the Iran-Contra hearings, grilling of Oliver North, the American public got a glimpse of a, quote, highly sensitive, close quote, secret that North had been involved in emergency plans to suspend the American Constitution in the event of a nuclear attack. And I'm going to quote from the hearings, and this was printed the next day in the New York Times. But as you listen to it, you may be interested that not one newspaper ever commented on the content of this interchange. Congressman Jack Brooks from Texas. Thank God for Texas. Colonel North, in your work at the NSC, were you not assigned at one time to work on plans for the continuity of government in the event of a major disaster? And then North's lawyer jumped up, Mr. Chairman! And then the senator, Daniel Inouye, who was a Democrat, the chair of the committee, responded in a way that showed he knew exactly what Brooks was referring to. And this is what he said. I believe that that question touches upon a highly sensitive and classified area, so may I request that you not touch on that. Jack Brooks, I was particularly concerned, Mr. Chairman, because I read in Miami papers and several others that there had been a plan developed by that same agency, a contingency plan in the event of emergency, that would suspend the American Constitution. And I was deeply concerned about it and wondered if that was an area in which he had worked. I believe that it was, and I wanted to get his confirmation. Nanonuyi again, may I most respectfully request that that matter not be touched upon at this stage. If we wish to get into this, I'm certain arrangements can be made for an executive session. End of quote. How many people never knew that happened in Iran-Contra? Well, it sort of freaked us at the time, and then it just disappeared from view. We have never heard if there ever was or was not an executive session, or if the rest of Congress was ever made aware of the matter. Reportedly, Congress as a whole was bypassed altogether. Two books say that Congress was completely left out of this planning.
391.
In Mann's book, the program called for setting aside the legal rules for presidential succession in favor of a secret procedure for putting in place a new president and his staff. Alfonso Chardy wrote the definitive story about this back in 1987. And here's what he said. The planning called for, quote, suspension of the Constitution, turning control of government over to FEMA, emergency appointment of military commanders to run state and local governments, and declaration of martial law during a national crisis. Well, it's absolutely Orwellian to call this continuity of government, when in fact it's obviously plans for very, very radical change of government.
But raw force is only the last line of defense for the elite regime. Neoliberal planners introduced more subtle defenses into the matrix. Looking at these will bring us back to our discussion of the left and right. Divide and rule is one of the oldest means of mass control, standard practice since at least the Roman Empire. This is applied at the level of modern imperialism, where each small nation competes with others for capital investments. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles.
434.
Throughout history, whenever different groups have come into contact, they have interbred. Any attempt to establish lines of division among biological populations is both arbitrary and subjective, close quote. The biological concept of race has no scientific basis. However, it does serve a political purpose, to divide people by maximizing their differences and minimizing their similarities. Racist assumptions are deeply embedded in the English language. The designations black and white divide people by skin color and exaggerate that difference. In fact, white people are not really white. They are various shades of beige. This can be demonstrated by holding a sheet of white paper against the skin. Black people are not really black. They are various shades of brown, including beige. It would be more color accurate to use the labels brown and beige. Using the terms black and white implies polar opposites, when all human beings are actually shades of the same color. Black and white are political labels, not colors. How natural is the tendency to classify people by skin color? A clever two-part experiment set out to answer this question. The researchers concluded that less than 4 minutes of exposure to an alternate social world was enough to deflate the tendency to categorize by race, close quote. Racial categories are so artificial that they need constant reinforcing to be maintained. Within societies, it works this way. If each social group can be convinced that some other group is the source of its discontent, then the population's energy will be spent in intergroup struggles. The regime can sit on the sidelines, intervening covertly to stir things up or guide them in desired directions. In this way, most discontent can be neutralized and force can be reserved for exceptional cases. In the prosperous post-war years, consensus politics served to manage the population. Under neoliberalism, programmed factionalism has become the frontline defense.
299.
The question, it's almost like a riddle, is when we all sit down together and gather around the multicultural table, what do white people bring? And the answer, of course, is the table.
The Matrix version of divide and rule. The covert guiding of various social movements has proven to be one of the most effective means of programming factions and stirring them against one another. Fundamentalist religious movements have been particularly useful. They have been used not only within the U.S., but also to maximize divisiveness in the Middle East and for other purposes throughout the empire. The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed.
225.
The moral voice of religious rhetoric in this country, I think, is either going to go the way of a Pat Robertson or the way of a Martin Luther King. Within the Bible, there are narratives which I would call holy war narratives. And that is this whole notion that calls forth the righteous warrior to purge evil out of the land. It's a moral development because, you know, something is happening in society that is frightful and fearful, and it's causing chaos and terror and people are dying. And so in reaction to that, religious legitimation is given for violence. And the religious person, without guilt, without shame, with the kind of conscience that can sleep well at night, will be given permission to purify the land for the good of all, even the good of the enemy that you're purifying. That's what I call the holy war narratives that are embedded in some of the scriptures. Those are the narratives that the Bush administration and the religious right wing in this country are really drawing on in a very powerful and in a very new way, I think. I'll give some examples of that in a minute. The other narrative, the one that Martin Luther King drew on, and I would say Jesus drew on, is what you call the prophetic narrative. Throughout Scripture, there is a storyline that is against empire. It's against the accumulation of power. And the prophetic critique of power, the one that says to the king, we need to limit your ability, that just because you make a decision doesn't mean that that has to be the rule of law, so to speak. And so the prophets arose to critique the exploitive business practices and the overreaching of power by the king, so to speak. And Jesus comes out of that tradition. And he speaks of compassion and mercy and inclusivity and welcoming the sinner, welcoming the unclean, because that's the way to peace, is you create a relational economy and you create a relational politics that reaches out and embraces the concerns of the least among them. Mr. Bush and the Bush administration use Jesus, but then redefine his message through holy war narratives, which Jesus never drew upon. And what we're hearing, the media expression of Christianity, is almost entirely this holy war narrative of purity. And it's driven by two branches. One that I think is very familiar to people, especially those who have ever seen these Left Behind books in stores. One is this apocalypticism, a catastrophic, you know, we're living in catastrophic times. The world is about to come to an end. But there is it's kind of like Freud's Thanatos syndrome. There's actually a desire for the world to come to an end because it's become so impure and things are so chaotic and people are so unrighteous that what needs to happen is a huge purifying of the land. The media expression of Christianity and many evangelical and fundamentalist churches are drawing upon these narratives that we are living in the end times. It's a theology of despair. How that translates, to give a case example, is why bother with the environment? Because we're not going to be around in 100 years. And so it's just not that important to create and build a sustainable society. Another way that translates that I think, again, might be familiar to many folks because it's in the media, and that's this absolute marching in lockstep with the hard right of Israel. There can be no critique of Israeli-Palestinian relationships, and nor is there linkage with the church in America and the church in Palestine. Rather, it's a wedding between the right wing in this country and the right wing in Israel. It doesn't matter what Israel does to the Palestinian people.
The collective energy and dedication of true believers makes them a potent political weapon that movement leaders can readily aim where needed. In the U.S., that weapon has been used to promote censorship on the Internet, to attack the women's movement, to support repressive legislation, and generally to bolster the ranks of what is called in the Matrix the right wing. In the Matrix, the various factions believe that their competition with each other is the process that determines society's political agenda. Politicians want votes, and hence the biggest and best organized factions should have the most influence, and their agendas should get the most political attention. In reality, there is only one significant political agenda these days: the maximization of capital growth through the dismantling of society, the continuing implementation of neoliberalism, and the management of empire. Clinton's liberal rhetoric and his playing around with health care and gay rights are not the result of liberal pressure. They are rather the means by which Clinton is sold to liberal voters, so that he can proceed with real business, getting NAFTA through Congress, promoting the WTO, giving away the public airwaves.
193.
The FCC, whose members tend to serve the same class interests as most of the rest of the government, is coming under increasing fire for its giveaway of the allegedly public broadcast spectrum to be the money machines of a few giant corporations who strive to dominate the arena of culture and discourse in the interest of their bottom lines. These media empires are devoted to consumerism and profit-making as the essence of Americanness.
682.
In 1934, Congress passed the Communications Act, sealing the future of America's broadcasting as a for-profit system.
NBC, CBS, ABC, these huge empires, were built upon the gift for free of monopoly rights to government property. It was an extraordinary corporate welfare that boggles the mind.
Giving away the public airwaves, justifying military interventions, and so forth, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I repeat, issues of genuine importance are never raised in campaign politics. This is a major glitch in the matrix for those who have eyes to see it. I'm reading from an article, Escaping the Matrix, by Richard K. Moore, first published in June of 2000. The matrix cannot fool all of the people all of the time. Under the onslaught of globalization, the glitches are becoming ever more difficult to conceal, as earlier with the Vietnam War. November's anti-establishment demonstrations in Seattle, the largest in decades, were aimed directly at globalization and the WTO. Even more important, Seattle saw the coming together of factions that the Matrix had programmed to fight one another, such as left-leaning environmentalists and socially conservative union members. Seattle represented the tip of an iceberg. A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry spot.
Well, they tell me that the world turned upside down. You gotta pick it up and shake it, gotta turn it around. You gotta take it apart to rearrange it.
The protests outside definitely gave the developing country delegates heart.
Don't let
you know, it gave them the encouragement to stand their ground. I think this was the first time the developing countries had felt supported. And I think the protests on the outside gave them the sense that they were right in what they were doing, that they were right in holding out. You know, it gave them the encouragement to stand their ground, and the moral support and the psychological support and all those things that help you stand up to a bully.
Apart from derailing the agenda of the WTO, as a moment, the Seattle result was seminal for the forces of popular globalization. Although the media was to coin the absurd phrase anti-globalization to describe what had happened, for many, the events of that week signaled the birth of a new global justice movement, a new global solidarity, and a new global consciousness.
A mass movement against globalization and elite rule is ready to ignite like a brush fire on a dry, scorching day. The establishment has been expecting such a movement and has a variety of defenses at its command, including those used effectively against the movements of the 1960s and 1970s.
19.
In practice, any political demonstration or action where the participants attempt to thwart corporate power is considered criminal activity. The repressive police response to demonstrations in Seattle and Washington, D.C., and the preparations for more of the same at the upcoming conventions are part of a plan first created in the 1960s to preserve order by using military force to suppress dissent.
If, for any reason, you haven't seen the military violence which is dished out to peaceful protesters who get in the way of the corporate machine, whether it's at an FTAA protest or just because they want to keep their indigenous land or whatever it is, I would encourage you to take a look. That was one of the first things I downloaded with my broadband internet connection, videos which protesters had shot of police running wild with all their riot gear. And that was a jaw-dropping moment for me, just to see, firstly, the violence, and secondly, to realise that there was another world which I was never going to see on corporate media, another whole set of truths. So that was one of the stepping stones that took me down this road of producing the show that I'm now doing. So if you're one of the people who uploaded video, if you felt that the world needed to know, then be encouraged, at least as far as I'm concerned. That was a very important discovery. And whilst we're on the subject of jaw-dropping moments, discovering Alan Frankovich's film about Operation Gladio was a big one for me, to see that NATO had organised a campaign of bombings against Italian civilians for its own clandestine purposes. That encouraged me to rethink what I thought I knew about terrorism, counter-terrorism, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. So let's continue with Silvio Federici from episode 327, exploring, I think, another very important and useful parallel, which I hope will help you to understand why I don't use the word terrorist on Wikispooks, except within quote marks. Now, let's pick up on Professor Moynihan Lasrig, whom we heard from in the introduction. This is from episode 327.
The witches were the terrorists of the 16th and 17th century. You know, the witch hunt was, in a sense, very analogous in many ways to what the war on terror is today. For example, the concept of the terrorist is now defined in such a broad way that can be used to persecute many different types of behavior, which the state wants to see criminalized. And I want to start my discussion of the witch hunt to say that this, in fact, was the case, you know, with the definition of women as witches, you know, which became the label for evildoer. And under the label, a very large variety of types of behavior could be persecuted, even though on closer examination you can see that those types of behavior were somewhat interconnected, and that, you know, the attack waged on witches as the attack waged on terrorists, and the use of terrorism as a charge, in the end, has very definite objectives it tries to reach. Today, a terrorist can be defined in the United States, according to the Patriot Act, as a person who seems to be trying to influence the policies of the state by their behavior. So, even though obviously there are in the world some people who use terror as a political weapon, clearly under the label of terrorist, many, many people, in fact, probably most of us, can be charged with that. Strikers have been described at times in ways that makes them very close to terrorists, anti-war protesters, and so forth. You find in the persecution of the witches of the 16th and 17th century the very similar situation. The label of witch became a label that was sufficient to have a woman arrested, tortured, and executed, even though no proof of crimes committed might be available. There's another, by the way, there's another